Hello and welcome to another episode of Historical True Crime, the podcast where we take a look back at history's darkest crimes and criminals. I'm your host, Lizzie, and today is episode 75. We're delving into the horrifying case of the New Orleans trunk murders today, which will definitely give you the chills. Imagine this. The energetic capital of Louisiana, New Orleans, is renowned for its diverse music, art, and food. However, beneath the surface of this vibrant metropolis is a story of terror from the early 20th century that shook the nation. The peacefulness of the community was upended by a grisly discovery in the year 1927. Two women's mutilated bodies were discovered in two trunks in an apartment. But who could carry out such a horrific deed? And what on earth could push someone to such a level of depravity? Come along with me as we take a trip through history, revealing more about this unsettling case as we go through the evidence and consider the hypotheses that are still shrouded in mystery. So take a seat, dear listeners, and get engrossed in a tale that will linger in your mind long after this episode has concluded. In order to understand the New Orleans trunk murders, we first have to immerse ourselves in the colorful 1920s, when jazz was popular and the French Quarter served as a focus of all things interesting and dynamic. Imagine this. Alleyways lined with elaborately ironwork balconies. Gaslit streets filled with the scent of Creole food and the reverberating sounds of brass bands. This was the 1920s New Orleans, a mingling pot of cultures, where the spirit of celebration coexisted with the mysteries that lingered in the background. With its winding alleys and secret courtyards, the French Quarter was a world unto itself, a haven for storytellers, artists, and bohemians who came to escape. However, beneath the cheerful festivities and glass clinking and speakeasies, there was a seedier side to the city. A world where the humid air carried whispers of forbidden desires, and where voodoo ceremonies whispered of long-forgotten secrets. Speakeasies flourished behind closed doors, dishing out illegal spirits to a clientele desperate to escape the harsh realities of the outside world. It was a time of prohibition, when the unlawful thrived in the shadows. However, danger was always present, even in this seemingly carefree environment, as the tragic events that would come to be known as the New Orleans trunk murders would brutally illustrate. As we dive into the sights and sounds of this bygone era, let's keep in mind that even in the city of dreams, nightmares can come true. Beneath the surface of this brilliant city lay secrets darker than the shadows themselves. A large portion of the French Quarter was an immigrant-populated working-class district in the early 20th century. These old houses retained their enchanted quality, drawing bohemians such as Sherwood Anderson, William Faulkner, Lyle Saxon, and other artists who soaked up the colorful, energetic vibe and profited from the cheap rent. A shadow had been cast over these areas less than 10 years earlier due to the haunting presence of the notorious Axeman, who we covered in an earlier episode of this podcast. This killer preyed on Italian immigrants and added to the city's attraction. The quarter continued to be a hotbed of crime. But let's switch gears and talk about the people that this story is actually about. According to Scott for NOLA.com, putting food on the table would have been top priority for brothers Henry and Joseph Moiti, who were originally from New Iberia. When they moved into the second floor apartment at 715 Ursuline in the summer of 1927, along with their two wives and five combined children. Recently, the Moiti family was forced to leave their Esplanade Avenue home due to unpaid rent. From a cash flow perspective, it appears that not much changed with their relocation. Joseph had not been working for quite a while, excluding small jobs he would find here and there, and a brief but unsuccessful career as a streetcar motorman, according to the Times-Picayune. Henry Moiti, who was 5 years younger than Joseph and 30 years old, was only slightly more employable. He was a Navy deserter who sometimes painted signs, but he did notably work as a butcher's assistant before relocating, according to reports. Joseph testified that neither marriage was happy. Teresa, Henry's wife, and Leonidi, Joseph's wife, were rumored to have had side relationships, and Henry was a heavy drinker. Joseph had made the decision to end his marriage, packing up his belongings and sending his two children to live with their grandparents in New Iberia. Henry was left behind with Leonides, Teresa, and their three children. Even those with moderate means could afford domestic help in 1920s New Orleans. And on October 27, 1927, housekeeper Nettie Compass arrived to clean the Moitys' flat and was met with a scene of gruesome chaos. George William Healy, a local reporter, was informed by two insurance men who were conveniently nearby and promptly joined the panic cleaning lady. In his autobiography from 1976, Healy explained what they found. "We found red stains on the floor and saw a large trunk in a bedroom partially open. When I pulled up the trunk lid, a woman's body, arms and legs severed from the torso, was exposed." Healy would use a neighbor's phone to call for a second reporter before speculating that calling the coroner now might be acceptable. Healy's female coworker Gwen and the coroner arrived. Quote, "She charged into the apartment and sighted several objects on a bed. Look," said Gwen, holding up these objects, "lady fingers." Four fingers had been cut from a woman's hand. After placing the fingers back on the bed, Gwen moved on to the second bedroom, where she found another trunk and opened it. It contained a second woman's body. A bloodied cane knife, the kind used on sugar plantations, was resting on the torso. It was then discovered that the lady fingers belonged to Teresa, whose wedding band was found shoved into a large wound on her back. A gold bracelet dangled lightly from the wrist of an arm, and hair clumps were scattered across the floor. Dr. George Rowling, the coroner, examined the site and concluded that the two women had likely been beaten with a lead billy club before being expertly dismembered and having their heads removed with a cane knife. The victims were officially identified as Henry and Joseph Moitys' wives, Teresa and Leonidi or Lonnie Moity. Among the horrific scene were Teresa and Lonnie's personal belongings, including children's clothes, abandoned sewing projects, women's lace attire, silk stockings, and beauty creams. The testimony of people involved in the investigation and the tabloid-style press coverage provide most of the scant information regarding Teresa and her sister-in-law Lonnie. The husbands of the victims received most of the attention from the media, who only really discussed the women's suspected infidelity and alleged negligent parenting. A story by Lonnie contains the sole glimpse into the women's private life. It's thought to be a barely concealed autobiographical story that she attempted to publish in a well-known women's magazine and was found in a cabinet in her bedroom. Parts of the story were featured in a brief article on the women's personal effects published by the Times Picayune. The story is thought to have been written by Lonnie before they left New Iberia. And this story serves as a cautionary tale about finding happiness again after a bad marriage. The author describes her happy life in her little hamlet with her husband and their young children, despite their poverty. However, she ends with a dire warning. "Now to you readers, young girls especially, please think ahead of you and do not make the mistake I've made. Because it does not always turn out the right way, you can still be disappointed. Guess it was only my luck to be happy like this. So I warn others not to take the same risk." Her father's warning? "Be careful, for marriage is a life sentence." A rejection letter from the prominent women's magazine was found nearby splattered in blood. But one item was conspicuously absent from the gory scene as police and journalists assessed it. Henry Moity. Investigators would piece together the turbulent story of the family from the jumbled clues. Recently, Joseph left Lonnie after learning about her adultery. Henry and Teresa's conflict was still simmering at the same time. For underneath their apartment, there was a real estate office on the ground level run by Joseph Caruso. Caruso and Teresa started flirting in the quiet periods when Henry wasn't home. Lonnie and Teresa had packed up their belongings into two trunks and announced they were both leaving on October 26th, the day before they were found murdered. Henry started drinking and came up with a plot to kill the women while intoxicated. He entered the bedrooms and started his horrific work, only after the women and children had fallen asleep. Henry's wife and sister-in-law were easily dissected thanks to his expertise as a butcher's assistant. Following the discovery of the deceased, authorities began looking for the wives' husbands. Joseph promptly handed himself in, stating that he was living with his sister and had been split from his late wife. So Henry became the immediate target of a search. 2 days after the murders were made public, Henry was turned in by the crew of a cargo ship attempting to leave the city. Henry would spin a tale about a Norwegian sailor who forced him to watch as he killed the women, but his story soon fell apart, and Henry would confess. He admitted to the deaths and gave specific reasons for his actions, all while maintaining that drinking had clouded his judgment. He was furious because he thought his wife was having an affair with Joseph Caruso, the couple's landlord. And according to Henry's account of events, Teresa's impending plans to leave him, combined with her infidelity and child neglect, were what finally drove him to seek revenge. In addition, he was angry with Lonnie, his sister-in-law, for allegedly having a bad effect on his wife. Coroner George Ruling mentioned the murderer's proficiency with a knife during the trial. The Times Picantu reported he said, quote, "The killer who decapitated Mrs. Henry Morty knew enough not to try to cut through the bone, but to cut through the joint. The appearance of the head of the wife of the defendant indicated that it had been skillfully removed. Henry, we do know, had been employed as a butcher's assistant prior to moving to New Orleans." Different judges presided over separate trials for the two murders, but Henry would receive two concurrent life sentences after being found guilty in both cases. On July 6, 1928, Henry began his sentence at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. It seems that he was granted unusual leniency for a man found guilty of two heinous murders. Henry was assigned specific tasks and received less guarding than other inmates, especially when he was appointed as a trustee of the prison in 1934. During a normal routine trip to the post office in the summer of 1944, Henry would take a cab to Hammond, Louisiana. He boarded the Illinois Central Panama Limited on his way to Chicago. At that time, the Louisiana prison camp superintendent didn't really appear to care that Henry had escaped. Since Henry had already been in prison for 16 years, he expected he would simply return of his own volition. But it would be over 2 years later in 1946 when police in St. Louis, Missouri stopped Henry due to suspicious behavior. After revealing his true identity, he was sent back to the Louisiana prison. And in 1947, the Louisiana Pardon Board actually recommended his release. So Henry Morty would be released 21 years after murdering his wife and sister-in-law. It turned out that his early release was a grave error that almost ended the life of another young woman. Henry relocated to California in an attempt to start over. In 1956, Henry shot his girlfriend, Alberta Orange, in the chest at a hotel in Los Angeles, puncturing her lung. He would be found guilty of attempted murder and assault with a deadly weapon, and given a 5-year term in Folsom Prison. While completing his stint at Folsom in 1957, Henry would suffer a stroke and pass away. And today, not much now sets the ordinary 19th century townhouse apart from its neighbors, except that it was once the scene of a gruesome crime. The home remains silent about the wild and violent event that took place inside it, although the co-owner recently told the Times Picantu that the place is absolutely not haunted, but tour guides will tell tales about paranormal activity here. It's a lovely house that unfortunately had this really tragic thing happen in it in the 1920s. Though a local legend, the Sausage Ghost, might carry on Henry's legacy. A story from Gumbo Yaya, a 1945 compilation of Louisiana folklore, describes a young woman who was murdered by her butcher husband and then converted into sausages to be sold to unknowing customers on Ursulines Avenue. One of the most important aspects of Henry's two trials was his prior work as a butcher's assistant. Furthermore, the newspaper reports that on November 2, 1927, while he was incarcerated awaiting trial, he made the following threat to the man he thought his wife had an affair with. "If I ever get my hands on that Joe Caruso, I'll chop him up into little pieces. Not big pieces like my wife, but little pieces. My God, I'll make him look like something that's been run through a sausage mill." Although Henry didn't actually murder anyone and sell them as sausages, the legend was certainly probably inspired by his life and crimes. While the New Orleans trunk murders cast a long shadow over the city's history, it's far from the only chilling crime to have left its mark in New Orleans. With its rich tapestry of cultures and complex history, it's been the backdrop for several infamous historical crimes that have captured the public's attention. One such case is the story of Madame LaLaurie, a prominent socialite in 19th century New Orleans, whose elegant facade hid a horrifying secret. Delve into the depths of the French Quarter and you'll uncover tales of torture and cruelty inflicted upon enslaved individuals in Madame LaLaurie's mansion, a story that sent shockwaves through the city and sparked debates about morality and justice. Then, like I mentioned earlier, there's the mysterious tale of the Axeman, a serial killer who terrorized the city in the early 20th century with a series of brutal attacks. With his signature weapon, an axe, and cryptic letters to the local press, the Axeman cast a shadow of fear over New Orleans, leaving residents paralyzed with dread as they wondered when and where he would strike next. We've covered both of these cases in earlier episodes on the podcast. But let's also not forget the unsolved murder of Mary Jane Sirloin, a young woman whose lifeless body was discovered in the Mississippi River in 1927. Despite extensive investigations and numerous theories, the circumstances surrounding her death remain a mystery. These are just a few examples of the many historical crimes that have woven themselves into the fabric of New Orleans' past. From tales of horror and tragedy to mysteries that continue to baffle investigators to this day, the city's history is punctuated by moments of darkness. So, dear listeners, as we bid adieu to the New Orleans trunk murders and the other dark chapters of the city's history, let's remember to cherish the light that shines through the darkness and to seek out the beauty in the midst of chaos. And of course, to honor the memory of those whose lives were tragically cut short. And that brings us to the end of another episode of Historical True Crime. Please remember to review, rate, subscribe if you've enjoyed it. You can also follow us on social media on Instagram at Historical True Crime Pod or on Facebook at Historical True Crime Podcast. If you have a suggestion of a case or a crime to cover for an upcoming episode, you can reach us by email at historicaltruecrimepod@gmail.com. And we'll see you next week for another dark, notorious case from history. We'll see you then.